A baseball game, a day in a park with friends and family, fishing in a remote stream, work, travels, providing for loved ones, or heading out for adventures. Whatever you do, whatever you enjoy, you need your health. The original Guide to Men's Health is presented by the Washington State Urology Society to help take you through the steps necessary to get the most out of life. If you have invested in a retirement plan for your future, why not invest in your body? After all, it makes better sense to retire healthy and enjoy your future. These podcasts are a guide for how to take care of yourself. If you take care of your car and maintain it, why not do the same for your personal machine, your body? If you know you should but haven't yet, the information in these podcasts contains some easy recommendations for where, when, and how to get started. Follow the podcast as we explore men's health with renowned experts and embark on a journey towards better health. On today's episode, we have the pleasure of interviewing Dr. Hilary Cash, PhD, mental health counselor, co-founder, and chief clinical officer of Restart Life. Restart Life is the first residential and transition program treating internet and video game addiction. Dr. Cash, welcome.
Happy to be here.
We had a prior episode where we looked at dependency and addiction, primarily about opioids. Thinking about addictions, there are many other types of addictions, sexual health addictions, gambling addictions. I was unaware that people got addicted to the internet and video games. Give us a little background and your specialty and how you came about with expertise in a program that is really dedicated to internet and video game addiction.
I first moved to the area back in 1993 and opened my private practice in Seattle in 94. One of my earliest clients was a young man of 25 who had already lost his job at Microsoft. He was losing his marriage and his second job, and it was all because he could not stop playing a multi-user domain game of Dungeons and Dragons. And this was for me a complete revelation because I knew nothing about the internet really, except what I might have heard on the radio. And I certainly didn't have a computer of my own. So this was just a window into a universe that I knew nothing about, but was very intrigued by. I had my own young child at the time, and I was just somewhere in the back of my mind thinking, I need to understand this because I have a feeling I'm seeing the trickle before the flood. My awareness around this was increased by other people coming in just over those early years of the mid-90s with essentially what was clearly addiction to some aspect of the internet. Somebody was a day trader. Somebody was very addicted to their writer's forum online and the affair that they were having with somebody. Somebody else addicted to pornography, more gamers coming in. And what was the reason I understood it to be an addiction that they were struggling with is that their lives were falling apart as a result. They could not stop themselves engaging in these ways, whatever those ways were. Back then, there were very, very few people who were noticing it and talking about it and writing about it, but there were a few. And so just over the 90s, I was developing some expertise in this and talking to the other therapists that I was able to find who were also noticing this and worried about it and trying to learn about it. So we were teaching one another about this really at that time. And back in 99, I started a place called Internet and Computer Addiction Services. It was an outpatient clinic. And the person that I co-founded it with, Jay Parker, was mostly interested in sex addiction and working with sex addicts. And I helped him by working with the partners of those sex addicts. But always interested in and concerned about the lack of treatment options for people who needed a higher level of care around video gaming. This was before social media really became a thing, but we nonetheless still had those internet and video game addicts. And I was just lucky in 2009 to meet Cosette Ray and her husband, and we were able to start this and provide that higher level of care, which was unavailable anywhere else at the time.
When does something move from a vice or a habit or a free time event to something that is totally addictive.
The key to understanding addiction, be it a chemical addiction or a behavioral addiction, is that loss of control, the inability to stop, even when you recognize that it's doing harm to your life. And that's the critical thing. And because it's doing harm to your life, an addict's life spins more and more out of control. When it comes to the behavioral addictions that are facilitated by the internet is the delivery system for the content, and it's the content which is addictive. So for some people it is sexual content, and we would call them sex addicts. For some people it's video games, they're video game addicts, social media addicts, gambling addicts. These are all behavioral addictions that are being facilitated by access to the internet. And because it is now we have smartphones, that has simply increased access to those drugs. Some people are addicted to multiple aspects of the internet, and other people sort of keep their interests more monofocused. But most of the people we work with here have been handed their delivery system and the drug by their parents when they were very young. And parents, not knowing what they were doing, having really no clue about the addictive potential, aren't these days handing their kids, you know, smartphones and gaming systems that deliver this potentially addictive content to people who don't have basically a prefrontal cortex, which is the seat of that ability to control impulses and think about consequences, think ahead. These are children. They're incapable of that. They need parents to provide that function. Parents do provide that function for the most part when it comes to drugs, including alcohol. Parents know you don't hand drinks to your little kid, but parents have no clue at all about the problems with gaming consoles and unfettered access to the internet. And so kids of a very young age are getting addicted.
Do most of these people really start out in childhood, or is this something that you find in your clientele could come along later in life?
It's interesting when we reflect, we here at Restart, who've been doing this a long time, and we reflect about the profile of the clients who were coming to us 10 years ago and the profile of the clients coming to us now. Many aspects of that profile are still similar, but back then we had a lot more young adults who really didn't start heavily using the internet and video games until they were actually older teenagers, 16, 17, 18, 19. That's kind of when they just jumped off the cliff and fell into an addiction. And so when you've got somebody who doesn't really start problematic use until then, they have a memory of what life is like, and they've been developing in many normal ways up until that point. And they have a memory of having played sports and having learned a musical instrument and playing tabletop games with their friends and getting together and being outdoors and running around and so on and so forth. But what we're seeing is more and more adults coming to us who really don't have those, have not had those experiences. Fewer and fewer have had those experiences because they have, in fact, gotten hooked when they were very young, in early elementary school often. And that's where they have spent their free time, rather than being physically active, learning other hobbies, developing their social skills. Instead, they have just been online and in front of screens. And so they don't have memories of really kind of what life was like without. And so for them, the damage is much deeper, and they have a much longer recovery period because they have to develop interest in the world.
Let's look at an adult or young adult who's out into a career, but perhaps there's pressures at work, maybe there's financial pressures at home, maybe relationship issues aren't working out. People try to deal with that. We would suggest that if it gets too bad, they see somebody to help them with that. Mm-hmm. Therapists are available. But when would somebody take a path where they would isolate themselves in front of their computer?
When somebody has a problem and they go seek help, the therapist is going to take a history. and really like look at what it is that has fueled their choice to isolate in front of a screen rather than dealing with the things that they need to be dealing with. And that choice of isolating in front of a screen has led them into now an addiction, and they're really trapped there because they can't get out. You know, it's that loss of control. If they don't start having that problematic use, then there's no knowing what it is that's led them there. They might have a co-occurring disorder. They might be depressed. They might be anxious. They might have ADHD. These are all conditions that predispose somebody to want to escape the pain of those conditions, and those conditions make them more vulnerable. Certainly PTSD and childhood trauma, even if it's a small t trauma, which is sort of chronic and less noticeable as trauma, all of these things make people more vulnerable. These are the kinds of conditions that might lead somebody who is very young to go toward screens and the escapism that they can, the escape that they can find through a screen. But if we're talking about somebody who really hasn't been escaping until they're older, they actually have relationships, they actually have screens, they actually have careers and relationships in their lives, then we just have to look at whatever it is that made them vulnerable. But again, screens are everywhere. They're ubiquitous. We hold them. We hold powerful computers in our hands and call them phones when they're really not phones, they're computers. You put those things together and you might find somebody uses that as their escape from pain and difficulty.
Going back to looking at childhood development, mm-hmm. where a child is exposed to computer games and this availability of looking at a screen. Now that child goes to school, mm-hmm. has interaction with peer group, maybe has some outlet time where they can be physically active, maybe is in a sport, but comes home and gets a computer. Are they at the same risk?
If you have a child who goes to school, first of all, schools are giving screens to kids. So kids are spending a lot of free time when they might actually be outdoors running around and playing, actually with screens still. So again, availability is screens are made available to kids in schools now. So they might spend much less time than you would think actually running around and socializing. They may find some other nerds who are that they can sit around and talk nonstop about video games and sort of keep those neural pathways very activated. If they're already addicted to video games, let's say, and they're sitting around and they're talking about the video games and they're keeping all of those pathways very activated. And so, again, even though children are going to school, it doesn't mean that they're necessarily really having good, healthy experiences that take them completely away from screens and allow them to experience all these other facets of real life that they need to be experiencing, they should be experiencing, we want them to be experiencing, but they might not be really experiencing.
So are the educators aware of that potential?
Not enough. Not enough by any means. There's a wonderful book I can recommend to those who are listening called Screen Schooled. And it's really about kind of, it looks at the history of how screens have been pretty uncritically adopted by schools. And it's a whole cultural thing. It's like, this is how we're going to put our kids ahead, without actually paying enough attention to the science, which is showing the detrimental effects of too much screens in schools. So no, educators, I think a lot of them are not thinking critically enough about the effects of screens in school.
Are the majority of your clients men?
They are. Yes,
so,
indeed.
So delve into that, because somebody driving right now who's listening and in a commute is going to go, huh?
Mm-hmm.
So explain a little bit about that.
Well, you know, I don't know of any research that's been done that would explain why it is that we get very few calls from women seeking our services. So this is speculation on my part about why we're working with men primarily. In 10 years of running an adult program, we've had 8 women I mean, it's pretty dramatic.
It's pretty profound.
It's pretty dramatic.
Yeah.
So I think that part of it probably is biology. That games are built as boys and men, I think, are drawn to the competition and challenge the games. And the games are very carefully designed to appeal to that competitive urge. Games are very well designed to appeal to guys. Women play games, but they tend to play more casual games and more cooperative games. And I think that those games are not as addictive as maybe the games that the guys are playing. And also, I think men are just garnered from the conversations I have with our clients. They seem willing to spend hours and days engaged with the game in front of a screen, essentially isolated from human contact, but so drawn into that fascinating competitive world that they are engaged in. Whereas I really do think that women feel a stronger urge to be face-to-face in relationship and are unwilling to be so isolated in front of a screen for days on end. And that social connection drive ends up being a protective factor. So that's what I think, but I don't know if I'm right. Certainly, the games that are highly addictive, and they're addictive because there are multiple layers of reward built into the games. It's also a pretty misogynistic culture. The games themselves tend to be misogynistic. There's a lot of misogynistic content to the game itself that's been built in, but also the culture of those playing it tends to be pretty misogynistic. And women often don't feel welcomed into those spaces or really safe in those spaces. And so the women I talk to, for the most part, tend to avoid playing those games. Or if they play them, they pretend they're men so that they don't have to deal with how they're targeted in the game. Let's just talk for a moment about physical health in many realms. Folks we work with tend to come in, almost all of them, universally severely sleep deprived. But in addition, they've been consuming fast food and soda, caffeinated soda. And so they have not been gaining the nourishment their bodies need, often for years. And they've been extremely sedentary for the most part. And so they have really, really some very, very serious health issues as a result. Diabetes, or they're pre-diabetic, severe vitamin D deficiency. They're often very overweight or extremely underweight because they just haven't felt appetite or haven't been willing to respond to their body's appetite because they're so engrossed in what they're doing online. It's part of what we try to do here is really address their physical health needs. And it's not unusual to see somebody lose a tremendous amount of weight over the course of being here or gain a tremendous amount of muscle weight over the course of being here because they're, we have a fitness program and they're getting physically fit.
If there's parents listening who have little mm-hmm. kids, let's just go back for a moment. What would your advice to them be about how much time they should allow their child to be interfacing a video game or a screen?
I have a recommendation of a couple of websites that they can go to and a couple of books that they should read. One website is called Families Managing Media, and they really ought to go there because they can get a lot of good information and a lot of support. Another is called Zone In, ZONEIN.ca for Canada. And Chris Rowan has wonderful resources, and she and I and someone, Dr. Andrew Doan, developed a nice handy-dandy chart that really says, okay, if this is your child's age, then this is the amount and type of screen content that you should be allowing. And so it's a very handy guide for parents to help them understand that children should not be having the kind of access to screen that in reality most children are having. And so anyway, those are two websites, and a fabulous book, which is good not only for parents whose children are not yet having trouble, but for parents also whose kids are having trouble, is by Victoria Dunkley, and it is called Reset Your Child's Brain. And what I like about her book is that she really reviews the literature in great depth on what the research is that's been done, and a lot has now been done, and what it tells us about what children need and the effects of too much screen use on children. So that's a really superb book. And there's a book called GLOW, G-L-O-W, GLOW Kids, by Nicholas Carderas. That's one of now a growing number of really very good books on this subject. But I think the thing that parents need to hear, maybe, who are listening to this, is that they need to really become conscious and think about their own screen use. They are modeling, and there are many, many, many parents who sort of endorse the idea that, yes, my kids' screen use should be limited because I figured out that their development will be enhanced if they don't have too much screen use. But the parent himself or herself is nonetheless on their own devices constantly. And so parents need to really challenge themselves to put their devices away, turn their devices off, and really have sort of set and carefully thought through times when they will use their own devices.
I imagine if somebody's been in front of a screen for many, 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 many years mm-hmm. and isolated, they may be happy being isolated. They may be happy that fulfillment in the world, their environment, is the screen, mm-hmm. whatever they're watching on the screen. Mm-hmm. So why would somebody all of a sudden decide, I want to give that up?
What usually has happened with the adolescents, it's a little different, and I can describe that to you, but what's happened for almost all of our adults is that they have failed out of college, and they have lost scholarships, they have wasted a great deal of money that their parents have spent. So typically, that's when parents find us. Parents say, okay, we see that there is a huge problem here. You just failed out of college. And, you know, you came home and you're not, in fact, promised you'd go get a job, but in fact, you're not out there getting a job. Or maybe you've gotten a job, but you just got fired because you didn't show up for your work. So clearly, you are not managing your life, and we are worried. You're isolating in your bedroom, down in the basement. You're not socializing. We can see you're physically unhealthy. You seem to be depressed, you know, we're worried. And that's when it's usually parents who contact us, and they get their adult child to us in a few different ways. Sometimes it's just a matter of having a firm, clear conversation and saying, we're worried about you, and we found a place we think would help you, and we want you to go. And sometimes that's all it takes. But denial, which goes along with addiction, I think of as a big plexiglass bubble around somebody, and it distorts everything. So if that plexiglass bubble is thin, that kind of a conversation is sometimes all it takes for the bubble to fall away and the person to say, okay, you're right, and I'll go get help. If it's thicker, they may have to take stronger action, and sometimes that is to hire an interventionist who will actually come and hold a formal intervention like you do with a drug addict. And sometimes it means a tough love approach of saying, we're not going to enable this addiction anymore. You're going to have to move out, and we're not going to support you. You've got to make your way in the world. Or you can go for treatment, but it'll be one or the other. So that's usually how people come.
In the adolescent situation?
In the adolescence, what's happened is that the kids are starting to refuse to go to school. And they are just holing up in their rooms. You know, they're big now. They're 15, 16 years old, 14. Parents can't just physically haul them to the car. They, you know, parents feel quite powerless to make their kids go to school. And so the kids are starting to refuse to go to school. These are usually bright kids, and their grades are just plummeting. And there's a great deal of family conflict, and it's not unusual for the conflict to get violent and for police to have to be called and, you know, parents to say, oh my gosh, you know, this has just spun so out of control, and clearly we are unable to handle the situation, and so they seek
him. And you also have referrals from other therapists. Somebody goes to a general therapist who says there's actually a specific recovery group,
right?
Which is
right.
Restart. Tell us a little bit about your program and tools that somebody may not be aware of.
The best tool of all is being away from screens for a prolonged period of time. So, be they adolescent or adult, when they come to us, they spend a minimum of 2 months away from all screens. And so during that time, the brain is upregulating to normal function. They're going through withdrawal and upregulating. And once they have done that, and we've seen on average it seems to last about 3 or 4 weeks, but at the end of that time, they're feeling so much better. And they report feeling so much better and clearer thinking. And while that's happening, we're also giving them healthy experiences. So they're eating healthy. We have lights out at reasonable time, and they have to get up at a reasonable time. And they're exercising. And the adults land first at our ranch. And so they've got chores to do. They're looking after animals. We have goats and horses and chickens and a dog and cats. And so they're beginning to shoulder responsibilities. We find that they often have a lot of empathy for the animals. They start really caring about the animals. But it's a pretty low demand period. They come in here once a week for a counseling session, but most of the time they're just there, mellowing out, socially interacting. They're no more than 6 at a time there. So it's this safe social environment. They have books to read. They have assignments of books to read, some writing exercises to do. But all of it is designed to get them thinking, reflecting, and detox. They go from there to Heavensfield, which is in Fall City. And now they come in here 4 days a week. And they're having multiple groups a day and at least one therapy session, sometimes more than that, depending on what they feel they need. And now they're diving much deeper into their work, and they're starting to look at the family dynamics that they came from, and they're really learning social skills and organizational skills, you know, because many of them don't have a well-developed prefrontal cortex, and so they are not, their executive functioning is not very good. So we're trying to teach them time management and organization and planning. So they're working on many, many, many different things. The idea is that by the time they finish the intensive part of the program, that they're going to be ready to function as adults in the world. And that's our transition program. So before they can transition, they've got to also have a good plan written. We call it the life balance plan. They have to really think through how are they going to reconnect with screens and the internet. And how are they going to manage that? Once they have a good plan in place and they are fully engaged in the program, we can see that they're functioning well and they have a recovery mindset. In other words, they know they have to live as addicts in the world, addicts in recovery. Then they're welcome to come into the transition program. And in the transition program, they're living now just down the street in apartments that Restart leases, and they rent, they pay their share of rent. They're getting part-time work and they're coming here to play. You saw the ping pong and the music room and all of that. They come here to enjoy themselves, to do their multiple groups and their therapy, and they can now use our computers in our computer lab for up to 2 hours a day. But those computers are monitored. We're holding them accountable to the agreements they've made about how they're going to use the internet going forward. That lasts about, on average, 6 months. It can last longer. And then we have a final program called Sustainability, where they move out, they find some buddies, they go and they sign their own lease on an apartment. And now they're working full-time, maybe part-time and back in college. Usually they start off at Bellevue College. And once they're in Sustainability, they often have their laptops back and their smartphones fully functional, because they're demonstrating that they are able to live sensibly as men in recovery.
And somebody who is in that situation, they're isolated, how long does it take before they can even begin to delve into developing relationships?
What we find is that they can develop relationships. Initially, the relationships they get comfortable with are with one another in the program, right? First, it's in that just 6 people at a time, so it's not overwhelming. and they are learning to relate, and they're coached all the time by the staff in how to relate, how to handle conflict, and that kind of thing. So that's the beginning. And then as they start coming here, they're now interacting with a larger community of Restart clients and having to, you know, get comfortable now with more people and more hustle and bustle. When they go into the transition program, they're now, as people out in the world working, I mean, it's difficult. It's truly difficult for them because they're so socially anxious. And so, you know, some of them avoid for a long time getting the job. You know, they're coming up with excuses to not take on that challenge, but eventually they all do. And that's often a real turning point for them, because now it's not just other addicts that they're interacting with. Now they're out in the world really interacting with just normal folks and discovering that they can do it. And it's an incredible boost to their self-esteem to discover that they can, in fact, do it. The biggest challenge comes a year down the road when they would like to date. And then, oh my gosh, this is just... And so it's a long, slow process.
Yeah, I was going to get to personal relationships, because that, by extension of just being out in the world, would seem more difficult if they haven't had the opportunity to do that.
That's right. It is. Very much so.
But you've had success.
Yeah,
so
we have.
So somebody shouldn't just throw in the towel.
No. Definitely not. For somebody who doesn't come to Restart, I strongly recommend, if you're somebody who's fearful out in the world and you tend to be avoidant, there's a wonderful 12-step program that I recommend, and it's Sex and Love Addicts Anonymous. And that is a program that really is built and designed to deal with problems with intimacy. And starting with the intimacy between, you know, this just non-sexual, non-romantic, just the intimacy of a good friendship, a good support person. And then that can expand. I mean, through that program, you really are guided in how to begin dating, developing a dating plan, how to do that. And you've got a sponsor who's there, right there in step with you, helping and supporting all the way. And our guys, we really encourage them to do that 12-step work.
And the name of the program again, they can
it's
find?
It's Sex and Love Addicts Anonymous.
Sex and Love Addicts
Anonymous. There are quite a few good meetings. And so I strongly recommend that for somebody who doesn't come to Restart but really wants to deal with their fear of intimacy and their lack of understanding about intimacy and what it's all about and how do you achieve it. That would be the program I'd recommend.
Oh, this is fascinating. Yeah, it's a world I had no idea existed or knew about. Any closing thoughts?
There's a term that I really love, and it's called limbic resonance. And limbic resonance refers to what happens when two people who are friends are face-to-face with each other or physically present with each other, interacting in a way where both of them feel cared about and safe. It releases a whole bouquet of neurochemicals in both of our brains. And those neurochemicals keep both of us regulated, both emotionally and physically. And babies need it all the time, but adults need it as well. It's not as though we outgrow our need for it. It's our birthright as social animals. We need that. The research is very clear that the more time people spend online, the more dysregulated they become, emotionally and physically. There's a strong positive correlation of depression with screen use. It does not fulfill. Screen socializing, being online, even if you're socializing online, is not an adequate substitute for the face-to-face, in-person relating that we actually need, because that's what generates and creates the limbic resonance. And if you're somebody who doesn't have the social skills to create that successfully, you need to seek help so that you can develop those social skills. You still can learn, and you can learn, but you have to learn in a different way. You have to get coaching around it and maybe therapy around it. But you can learn, because that's where your deepest and truest needs are going to be met, is in those face-to-face relationships.
Well, I truly appreciate your sharing information with us. I hope the listeners have found it rewarding. It's fascinating. So thank you.
It's been my pleasure.
This completes another podcast chapter of the Washington State Urology Society's original Guide to Men's Health. This is Dr. Richard Pellman reminding you to take care of yourself. The Washington State Urology Society wishes to thank all contributors who volunteered their time and knowledge. The information presented is the opinion of the speakers. The Society also wishes to thank Sean Fox for his invaluable technical assistance. Music theme, San Juan Bells, written and performed by Dr. Dave Weidig. The podcasts are the property of the Washington State Urology Society. Reproduction and use without the express consent of the Society is strictly prohibited. For more information about men's health, visit wsus.org or visit your physician or care provider.